Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
All right, we are live, I think. Yes, we are.
We are. Hey, you're being recorded. Abdullah, we got to tell you that for legal reasons. You know that, right?
Yeah. Maybe we don't have to tell him that. It says it right on the top of the page.
Armin, I'm sorry, is this loud?
No, your audio actually is low. I don't know why. Actually, that's a good thing. Let's keep it that way.
Okay.
I'm fixing it. I'm going to go maximum volume. That's good. Hello. Okay.
Hello.
That'll be fine. All right.
We're making fun of you, Ali, in the live chat.
Of course you are. Oh, why? Because that's okay. It doesn't matter. History is on my side. You guys can have the live chat audience. I'll just take history.
Okay. Sure.
Okay. That's a fair deal.
Whatever makes you feel that better.
But yeah. And so before we start this, I just want to say to everybody on the live chat who is obviously confused on this issue, right? As Armin is. Please go to Letters Wiki, where me and Matt Thornton, the jiu-jitsu
guy. Hey, Ali, don't start something because then I have to respond, and then you have to respond, and this is gonna go off tangent.
No, I'm not gonna make.
Say something and then not me responding.
The only thing you could possibly say to what I'm saying is that I'm not doing what I'm doing. I'm just saying that I have I have carved out my case in a conversation with Matt Thornton, right, on this issue. And please go and check it out whenever you get the chance.
I'll respond similarly and saying I make my cases on Aces Republic channel and go check that out.
That's fine. Yes, please do check out both. That's the whole idea. Like Matt
actually, guys, check out Ali's. A lot of people, Ali, you don't plug your channel, by the way. A lot of Ali has his own channel. Check out Ali Rizvi.
Yeah, I started this thing called Professional Novice. Professional Novice is basically is during this.
Wait, COVID the channel time. Is called Ali Rizvi, though.
Well, yeah, I don't know how to change that. I'll figure it out. I have to figure all these things out. I haven't been promoting it much.
Yeah, but tell people it's called Professional Novice, and the channel's name is Ali Rizvi, and people don't know how to find it. So you have to. You guys suck at this. But anyway.
Yeah, so it's called right now. It's called Professional Novice with Ali Rizvi, and the reason I started it is that a lot of times when I am talking about things that are not related to religion, Islam, atheism, and all that, I usually and sometimes when I just want to talk to my friends because I miss them during this COVID time, and Armin is going to be a future guest on it. He already committed.
Yes.
And what we do is on that channel, we get a chance to talk about things that we don't usually
Can you come on Atheist Republic and debate me on this on the disagreements that we have regarding this whole BLM?
Yes, if you let me talk, Armin. I heard a little bit of the. I think I'm probably one of the few people who knows how to. Yeah, I think I can do that. We'll do it.
Okay, good. Let's do that. On Atheist Republic. I'll come on your channel and you come on Atheist Republic.
Yeah, but so the whole idea is that you come on this channel. The thing is on Professional Novice, we talk about things that are not necessarily related to what people do. So Maryam Namazi, who's mainly an ex-Muslim activist, came on to talk about Black Lives Matter, which isn't something that she normally talks about on other forums. So that was the idea. So Armin's going to come on and talk about, we were going to talk about working out, right? Staying in shape.
We're going to talk about girls, working out, diet.
Yeah.
On your channel.
You're going to find out the side of Armin that you rarely ever see. So, here you go.
That's not a good thing.
It's going to be great.
That is definitely not a good thing.
Okay, so
Let's start.
Let's kick off this episode. We're basically just going to have fun over here. I don't want to take. We have a little bit of time with Abdullah because he's very, very disciplined in terms of when he sleeps and when he wakes up. You know, like he has to get up for Fajr and so on.
Yeah. So, I don't tahajjud and then I have to do Fajr and then I don't go to sleep. I have to do the, what's that salah called? Ishraq. You know, when the sun comes out, there's that other one. Yeah.
That's right. And I didn't do the. I didn't do the official greeting, but I want to keep all the stuff that we talked about. So yeah, everybody, you know, welcome to Secular Jihadist. This is the name of our podcast. It's called Secular Jihadist. And our guest today is actually one of our most popular guests in the past, who is here to talk about two really, really great episodes. One was on the Quran and the historicity, the history of the Quran, and the other was one on Muhammad. And Abdullah is back with us. Abdullah Gondal is here. He is absolutely brilliant. He's one of the most brilliant guests we've ever had. Extremely, his videos on, you do your own videos too, right? And you don't just do the stuff with Abdullah Samir?
I still haven't come out with my own channel. Like, it's been pushed back and back. But for now, like, I'm doing mostly content with Samir, mostly live streams, but sometimes we collab video projects as well. But then I also go on Haris Sultan's channel, Pakistani Mulhid, trying to focus on that a lot more because, you know, we're trying to reach an audience in Pakistan that is so isolated from these ideas and this new perspective of looking at Islam that I feel like I'd make a video and the same video would be just translated in Urdu and I'll get literally 10 times more views just because the idea is so new to the people there.
It is, yeah. And I think that what he's doing, we've had him on here a couple of times and he's been, you know, the stuff he's doing is having like incredible impact over there. So, Abdullah, what we are here to talk about, and I think this is going to be really fun, it's kind of easy in a way too, but it's just we have to, sometimes you got to have your fun, is we are going to talk about coronavirus and Islamic theology. And we're not just going to talk about coronavirus, to be sure. I mean, we're going to talk about just basically the kind of suggestions on, you know, medical science and you know, cures for illnesses that you know, Islam bestowed upon us. And, you know, this is what Allah's view is. And I can tell you that Allah's view on healthcare is very different from just whatever I was trained in when I became a physician. And that's probably one of the reasons I became an ex-Muslim as well. So
this just shows your arrogance, Ali, to think that you know more than the creator of the universe. By the way, I'm going to play the devil's advocate here of a Muslim apologist. I'm going to try my best, but go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, good luck with that. Can we start with the fly? Okay, I want
to
see.
Let's go to the corona stuff first.
All right, coronavirus, usually most of the conversations you're going to hear about it are going to be very serious, be very ominous, it'll be very scary. It's obviously disclaimer, it's a very serious disease. We all know people who have been affected by it, and you know, there are many people who have been killed by it. So all of that. Now, putting that to the side, what we want to do is we want to talk about some of the I don't even know how to introduce this. We're going to talk about how some other views on it. Okay, so here goes.
So
did the Quran predict coronavirus? Because it predicted everything else, apparently.
I would say no, but there I have seen people who have made that claim, and it's as far-fetched as, like, you know, those 5G towers starting the virus and stuff. It's like conspiracy theory, like those mathematical miracles are like, oh, this worse comes here. I have heard a few people say that, but generally no. There was, though, initially when the virus started, though, when the outbreak was in China, I remember Muslim Twitter and Facebook going crazy that Allah is punishing the Chinese for putting the Muslims in concentration camps and whatnot. So that was a whole thing. Disclaimer, I don't agree with China, what China is doing at all. But then it is ironic that the Kaaba then gets shut down and then, like, nobody can go pray there and it's all there. So then people are like, well, what happened now? It backfired, right? So there was that whole
okay, mindset. Brother, here, this is what you're doing right now. You're misrepresenting. You just went and found some ridiculous Muslims out there and you're trying to paint a wide brush about what the Muslim population is. If you had any understanding of what Islam, if you actually knew your Islam, you would know that the punishment, God does, the punishment is for the afterlife. Every misery that we're feeling in this life is not meant to be a punishment. It means to be a test. And it's also meant to be an excuse for us to get closer to Allah. It's an opportunity. It's not a punishment. So
please stop.
So please stop misrepresenting Islam just because some Muslims who are not scholars out there are saying some ridiculous stuff. This is not about Islam. This is just about them. Maybe just check your sources before you paint such a wide brush, okay?
And my also devil's advocate, don't you know the coronavirus is probably one of the things that will especially help you get very close to Allah, especially if you have comorbid conditions, if you have any sort of immunocompromised, if you're immunocompromised in any way. So you'll get actually very close to Allah.
Yeah. It's like a short way, you know, like it's almost like some people were saying it's like the rapture, but just a little
I understand that you ex-Muslims just like to make your small jokes here and there and get a cheap laugh out of your, you know, out of your own community. But again, you know what I mean. And you guys, you know, you could just go have fun with your insults. That doesn't, that God, Allah is powerful. And this means this is not going to,
You're not being a good apologist because you have to throw in words like yani and you have to say and jazakallah.
I'm not gonna do that. Come on. No, okay. I'm gonna do this for an English audience. Doing that's not good. That's not being a good apologist. You lose your audience if you do use those
words. I like it. It keeps the white people a little terrified every time
I'm being an apologist to white people. To English speaking people, not white people. So I'm not gonna use words that they don't understand. But go on.
So Abdullah, can you respond to all of Armin's bold? I mean,
I was just critiquing the mindset, right? Like the people have that this is because of our sins, and you know Allah is sending this test to remove our sins, and it just makes no sense. It's like, why would God need to test us or punish us or put through this misery and pain to take away our sins, right? You know, to purify our souls, as they say. But yeah, actually, one of the funny things was my dad initially a couple of months ago. He was saying that, why do you feel that the Asian, especially the Muslim countries, are the least affected by it? And I went on a whole conversation with him where he was and my family members were arguing that because the Muslims do wudu and stuff, and like, you know, they pray a lot more, like God's protecting them. But then now, I was talking to him a couple days back, and I'm like, okay, Pakistan now has 140 some thousand cases. Now what? Like, so it's very interesting, but the whole mindset of approaching this that God is punishing people is kind of very.
Notice how these ex-Muslims are celebrating the fact that Muslims are getting coronavirus. This is the this is the true true nature of ex-Muslims. Look, they just secret. They can't even hide their pleasure. They're just like, oh, ha ha, look at all these Muslims now getting disease. Look, this is what happens when you don't believe in religion. No, but guys. In the morality of Muslims.
I can make a better apologist claim. I can say that, you know, this is amazing what is happening. This is a sign from Allah. Look, everybody is wearing niqab, everybody is covering their face. All of the bars are closed. No,
that's just your own character.
All of the bars are closed. No, nobody is shaking hands with each other. Men and women are staying six
feet segregation
apart, right? And it's just that the whole thing is disproportionately affecting black people. So that's another thing.
It's a trial version of Sharia.
This is how you know, like, Muslims don't even understand what Muslims are saying. They think this is the best. They come up with these joke examples of some ridiculous Muslim saying stuff to try to represent what all Muslims are saying. They don't even go with the best arguments that they're making. They just go with the most ridiculous ones. This is, of course, they're ex-Muslim because this is their understanding of what the Muslim community says and stands for.
Okay. What does Islamic theology, Abdullah, what does about pandemics and plagues? I know that there are hadith about this. I know that there are many sort of different, you know, claims. Are there any Quranic claims? Are there any hadith that you want to bring to light that might help us see this?
There are claims, like, where there are some good things that Muhammad said. Firstly, get them out of the way. Is Muhammad did say if there's a pandemic, stay where you are and don't leave, which isn't miraculous advice. It's just generally, you know, just stay put, common sense. Mm-hmm. But one of the interesting things was he said that never will there be a pandemic or a big disease like this be able to enter, I think, the cities of Mecca and Medina, and there's angels guarding it. But we obviously saw that it definitely reached those lands, and the Kaaba and Masjid an-Nabawi were all shut down, and people actually died in those cities too. So it kind of brings back, like, that kind of disproves Islam, if you take that hadith to be true.
Is the Hajj being canceled?
Which hadith is that again? Like, you see the full content? Is it authentic? Is it like Sahih hadith?
Yeah.
Well, I'm a Quranist apologist, so you can't use that against me.
he's got it covered.
Yeah, it's Abdullah. You don't have to look it up. It's okay. We all know.
Okay.
We all know that. But he's just being an apologist.
As far as if I could find it. So one of the interesting things was actually, I was like reading up on this. People always question, like, how did the Muslims, these Arabs in these 23 years suddenly came from nowhere, rose up and destroyed the Persian Roman Empire? What I found was, like, around that era, there was a huge plague that affected Roman and Persian empires, and they were so weakened because of that. That's one of the reasons that allowed the Arabs to easily, like, trample over them in a sense, because that plague had weakened them economically and militaristically in such an insane way. And then also the same way with World War II, if you notice, like, you know, the flu pandemic after World War I, and then how Germany and everything, like, suddenly the Hitler guy comes around. So it's kind of interesting seeing, like, how these pandemics can actually have a huge effect on, like, you know, global politics and whatnot.
Isn't the rise of Islam, or I'm sorry if you mentioned this already, but like the rise of Islam, right, came during a phase of the plague, right? Yep. I mean, wasn't there a plague?
Because of the plague, Ellie. Yes. Because this is why this is why it was a shocking thing for people at the time. Two empires, one was completely defeated by Islam, and
Roman
one
Empire,
was
Persian Empire. Yeah.
And the other one was defeated in so many battles. I mean, it was shocking. It wasn't just the plague. It was also the fact that the Persian Empire and the Roman Empire, I mean, the Byzantine Empire, they were fighting with each other for so many years, and they both, like, depleted each other's resources. And that, with the plague, it was just perfect combination for something to just fill the vacuum. Almost like a miracle, guys. Almost like a miracle. Almost as if God had planned and prepared the world for his empire to rise.
Well, actually, this is what's interesting now that I'm thinking about it. The Hundred Years' War in France also had a person... like Joan of Arc just suddenly come from nowhere at the age of, like, a 17-year-old teenage girl, and just comes up, leads French army, topples, and plays such a pivotal role. But again, that was the same time when the bubonic plague was starting in Europe too. So it's funny that when these big pandemics happen, these characters come about and they kind of start these revolutions. But that's understandable because economic recession and all that follows kind of almost entails a new uprising with it. It's interesting to see that. But like Erman said, it's like a sign. It's like, you know, Allah plans, and he's the best of planners, and you can't beat him.
He's the best of planners. Yeah, there's a verse in the Quran that says, lo, who is better than Allah at coloring? Like, one of my favorite. No, I'm not kidding. This is one of my favorite verses in the Quran, actually, because as it says, it's like, you know, we color the people, and it says, lo, who is better than Allah in coloring? And that's it. I like just posting that to places and just
the weirdest one I find was I was just reading this surah, and I just suddenly come across this, Waqawaiba Atraba, where Allah is describing the blessings in heaven, and he suddenly says, and for the believing men will be women with perky tits. The word perky tits is there. And I'm like, what?
wait, hold on. I missed this. How do I not know that? Wait, say
there's a verse in the Quran that talks about the boobs of the hurs, and it says they're perky.
Are there translations? No, so it doesn't.
Yeah. It translates them as
firm breaths. That is a very tempting.
Oh, yeah. Firm breaths. I know about that. Like, I know that. And then the hadith actually qualify. Like, they are, there is a skin color thing. So, first of all, Islam, when it comes to the virgins in heaven, the whores in heaven, and, you know, this is a little bit of a tangent from coronavirus, but probably related because all of this stuff is related in some way. Everything's so bizarre. But
we're going to die from the coronavirus. We're going to go lay in the arms of the whores, you know? I mean,
I know, yeah.
Planning ahead.
Well, we call it the coronavirus, and that's why we quarantine. But the verses about the way the virgins are described in heaven, the whores, are, first of all, they're all wide-eyed. Okay, mm-hmm. They have wide eyes. That means that if you have an Asian fetish, you're done. Okay,
the second thing. But not if you have an anime fetish. That's
okay. Well, that's we're not talking about that Asian thing. Yeah. The second thing is that it talks about how fair they're going to be, and in the hadith, it actually elaborates this by saying that they will be so fair, so light skinned that they are going to be transparent, as in you're going to be able to see their bone marrow. This is a hadith that they are going to be so fair skinned that you can see their bone marrow.
Wait, so they have perkutes and you can't even see them?
No, you can see through their skin because that's how.
Yeah, so you're not going to be able to see their glorious perkutes.
If you're interested, the verse number is Surah 78, and it's verse number 33.
78:33. Okay, I'm going to check it out.
78:33. And like, if you go to the English translation, you select a bunch of them, you'll see all the different wordings.
Let me go back to the guys. You guys are making fun of this. This is just symbolism for you guys don't understand. God is talking to the Arab tribes at the time, and this is just symbolism for immense pleasure. And the fires of hell, it's not going to be literal fire. It's not going to be literal honey and milk and puris there. This is just for people at that time to understand that, like, what eternal bliss, whatever that is, this is just symbolism for all of that. Yeah, you just have to understand that. Yeah, you just have to understand what would the Arab in the desert, what would they see as the most, as the greatest reward?
This is
the greatest pleasure.
It's a mistranslation. The honey and milk is a mistranslation. If you look at the original Syro-Aramaic roots of the Arabic, classical Arabic words, it actually comes to bunnies and silk, right? And now, that if you draw parallels
what
to
the
Easter.
Hell? Are you being, you're not being serious. Okay, never mind.
I can't believe it. He actually
bought it.
You really thought it was about bunnies and silk? What? Jesus.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what we were talking
I'm gonna
about.
Give up on, I'm never gonna take you seriously on anything ever again, Ali.
Here, Armin's playing the apologist, right? So I'll throw a question at him.
Imagine
there is this evil scientist, right? And he was to create something.
Oh, hey, okay, like this. I like this.
Something like the virus we have right now. Mm-hmm. And then he purposefully infects the whole world, but then demands all the governments of the world to pay him large amounts of money and pledge him allegiance, and he has the cure to it. But then he's a psychopath and he wants everybody to worship him. What opinion of that person do you have?
That's not at all analogous to the God situation. Not at all. I can't believe you even... So ridiculous. Okay, so the difference is that you worshiping the scientist does nothing for you. Okay? Does nothing for you. Worshipping God is you getting close to God is the best thing you could wish for. This is just your arrogance and your ignorance of what it means to be close to God. Okay, becoming close to God is the highest reward. It's eternal bliss. The people who understand what being far away from God is, they fear that more than hell itself. This is why people, God had to come up with the symbolism of hell and eternal punishment, because people don't understand the misery and the pain associated with not being close to God. And this is why God had to come up with huris and virgins and all the blessings in heaven, because people don't understand what it means to be close to God. Worshipping a scientist just because he's a psychopath, that does nothing for you. That's just for the scientist.
No, but if he can
getting
give you
close, getting closer to God is not for God's sake, it's for your sake.
Well, but if you worship the scientist, he will like keep us alive and give us provisions and stuff, so that benefits us. But praying to God doesn't do anything.
But the scientist might need you for him. So God doesn't need you. God wants you to be happy. But this is a blessing to you. You think the miseries in this world is bad. You think like starvation is bad. You think the coronavirus is bad. You have no idea what misery is like. If you understand what being away from God is like, none of this would even show up on your radar as misery. God is trying to remind you that he exists by putting inconveniences, little small inconveniences in your life, so you're not attached to this world, because this world is blinding you from what God is actually, the real thing that God is offering you, for the real pleasure, for the real glory, for the real peace, and taking that away from you so that this world is like a covering on your eye, and God is just removing the blindfold so you can see what really matters. You have to be thanking God for this.
Jesus fucking Christ.
God sounds like this creator of this weird psychological experiment.
So what are, let's go on with this. So, you know, the coronavirus itself, I mean, the prophet said, I mean, one good thing that, you know, stay at home. You know, he talked about social distancing and about, you know, lockdowns and things, I guess, lockdowns. Like, you know, if there's a pandemic, then stay at home, which is great. Okay, he said that. What were some of the other suggestions that have been given in Islamic theology about, or I guess it would be the hadith mainly well, relating to plagues and relating to infections and things like that?
I mean, the thing was, one thing was very, very, very clear, that these people had no clue about the germ theory of disease. I mean, Muhammad would give his superstitious ideas all the time, you know, like for example, recite the Fatiha 7 times and then rub it on your body and it'll cure everything. Or like he gives, a lot of the times he'd attribute these things to magic, right? So he'd say, recite the last 2 quls or... There is this book that we used to have in Pakistan. It was a collection of select verses. I forgot what it's called. It's Panjasa or something, like Panjpara, or some, a few surahs, and you'd recite these over and over and blow them on you and stuff. But then there's the other funny ones where curing these with like black seed oil comes in. Like black seed oil is touted as the cure for everything except death. Then there's
everything except death. I like that they qualified that.
It's like, oh yeah, yeah. Way,
just in case you think that this cures all disease, it doesn't cure death.
Specifically mentioned.
Caveat.
But like with the honey as well, like the Quran would mention that. Then there's the fig, the olive oil. But the thing that steal the show.
Right about olive oil. Olive oil. Well, yeah. Not for infections, but it just in terms of. I think when it comes to heart health and, you know, it's got lots of omega-3 fatty acids and things like that. So,
but a lot of things like it alludes to that what Muhammad propagated or was normally medicine or medical tips, you know, like you kind of hear from ancestors passed on a generation by generation. And there weren't anything unknown to the time. And some of them are just like, kind of bizarre. Like if you were to go take his advice on how to cure stomach problems, like he did with suggesting people drink camel urine, or if a fly falls in your drink, you gotta take it and you gotta dip the other side in the drink because one wing has the cure and the other has the disease on it. So there are some very interesting ones there.
So I just want to just contextualize that. Well, I guess it may be illustrated visually for people. So the idea is that if there is a fly, right, what was it, in your drink, right? And it just dips one wing and it flies away, then you'll need to go and pursue the fly, catch it, so that you can come back and dip.
No, it's just like, the fly, okay, if the fly is on your
in
drink,
order,
you just dip it in. If it's, well, you don't go catch a fly.
Okay, Addy, wait, hold on. No, I want to, hold on. No, I want this clear. So you have a fly, you find a fly in your drink, right?
Right, so you don't know which one of its wing touched the water. Because every fly, according to this hadith, again, this is not Islam according to my Quranist views, but again, this hadith, this ridiculous hadith says that every fly on each one of its wings, one of the wing has a poison on it, and the other wing has a cure to that poison on it. So if you have a drink and a fly falls into your water, and like it's on your water, and you don't know which one of its wing had touched the water. So you just make sure you dip it fully in so that if the poison wing had touched the water, you also get the cure for the poison in that water so you don't die.
Armin, so this only really applies if you have a fly that has not completely... But both wings haven't. So you have to... This is a hadith for a very specific circumstance. It's actually quite... I think it's quite visionary.
That's hadith. We have hadith for very weird, very specific circumstances.
No, but this is great because it covers pretty much your entire life. It doesn't just cover, that's the thing about Islam is that it talks about every aspect of your life. It covers it, including the time when you may find yourself with a fly in your drink where both wings are not touching it. It's just one wing. So you look at it and then, supposing it's one wing, it just skims it, right? Just kind of skims it.
Ricochets off, you know?
Yeah. There's sometimes, you know skimming is not, it's not nothing. Skimming is a serious thing because I'll tell you something, right? You don't have to kick somebody in the balls to really, really hurt them. You just have to skim and that's it. And you're going to feel the pain. Skimming and grazing is a very, very...
This, my brothers and sisters, this is why...
No, I'm very serious about this, Armin. I'm very serious. So, So the fly goes in, it skims a wing, but I am right, Armin, because the thing is, after that, if the fly does fly away, if it just kind of touches one wing, flies away, you would actually have to pursue the fly and bring it back.
You just get another cup, okay? If you didn't get a chance to dip it fully in, you just... go get a new cup, okay?
So the phrase double dip, people don't know, but double dip, the phrase actually originated from Islam. It was one of Islam's contributions.
Can I respond to this?
Yeah.
Do I have permission from you, brother, to respond to this? This is why...
Allah gives permission, Armin.
This is why... No, that's bullshit. This is why you go... The Quran is the final and full authority. And this is why you're encouraging Islam to use your own logic. And if a hadith is not in according to sound logic, and if it's not in the Quran, and if it contradicts sound logic, you deny it, even if it's sahih hadith. This is why the Islamophobes like you guys really love the hadith, because you think it's as authoritative and as the Quran is. But it's not. We are, if anything contradicts the Quran, or if it contradicts your sound logic, then you deny it, even if it's sahih. And a lot of these sahih hadiths that you guys point to have only one chain of narration, okay? And if they have one chain of narration, you could easily dismiss them, okay? Because it's very unlikely for something that Muhammad have said and only one person have been reporting them, especially if it's something important, okay? Mm-hmm. So please take these two into account. If it do not trust the sahih, do not trust the hadith, definitely if it's not author, if it's not sahih, ignore it. If it has one, even if it's sahih, if it has only one chain of narration, be very skeptical about it. But even if it's sahih, and even if it has multiple chain of narrations, if it's not according to the Quran, and if it doesn't pass the logic test, then you could also dismiss it.
Okay, so let's do this. Let's move away. I know we can come back to the hadith later, right? And just remember, hashtag both wings matter. But when you come back, let's just move back and just zoom out and go to the Quran itself.
Notice how they have nothing against my points. You guys
No, that's because we accept it. We can't have anything. We want to keep our heads on our bodies. In the Quran, right, for instance, and the Quran, as we know, is the completely preserved literal word of Allah, as Yasser Qadhi recently pointed out in a podcast in a talk with Muhammad Hijab, right, where it's like completely, completely preserved and it's unchanged. What does it say about these scientific claims, especially about biology? And is there anything relating to what we're experiencing right now with the coronavirus? Because you got to understand, over here, it's old news. Like, we're all in North America. Coronavirus is old news. Who cares? But in places like Pakistan, a lot of these other countries, it's just picking up right now. Mm-hmm. In a lot of Muslim majority countries, just picking up. So we need to provide guidance. They should learn from not only from our experience, but also from revelation.
Mm-hmm. So what's your question?
Is there anything Quranic aside from the Hadith? Because you're obviously going to dismiss the Hadith if you're a Quranist. So is there anything in the Quran that we can talk about in terms of scientific claims? Okay, let's just move away from the coronavirus. Well,
you're asking Abdullah this, right?
I'm asking Abdullah.
Oh, okay. I was asking Armin because he was playing the apologist. In the Quran, per se, like, I don't see many, like, general good health practice. I mean, there's no mention of boiling water even. There is part like this to be clean in general, like tazkiyah, zakat, those words are very often. There are, would be like abstinence from alcohol would be one thing that could be good. Some ulama try to argue that using one verse in Surah Baqarah that smoking is haram as well. So there are some things that are good in that sense.
Smoking is haram or makruh?
Well, some ulama in the Salafi side, they do say it's also haram, because what happened was when the fatwas initially came out about smoking, it was just based off of the bad smell, and it was being analogous to garlic smell.
But most Muslims say it's makruh.
Yeah, that was because the initial fatwas were just about the smell of the smoke. But then later on, with more research, they found that smoking actually causes cancer. So then it becomes a problem of, you know, purposefully harming yourself slowly. So then some ulama said that there's a verse in the Quran, don't kill yourself with your own hands. And that's why, you know, smoking or anything harmful in that sense is haram, right? So there is that argument too. Then there are some good ideas like, you know, usage of olive oil, fig. They have a certain, then milk and honey as well. Yeah. Other than that, I don't know. Maybe that's about it.
Yeah,
they do mention pomegranates and fruits in Jannah, but that's just food stuff.
Yeah, the stuff in Jannah is completely different, because all the stuff that you're supposed to stay away from here, like, you know, alcohol, for instance, is just, there's loads and loads of it in Jannah, right? So Jannah is heaven for people who don't know.
The one thing,
makruh means, okay, so makruh means like it's discouraged, but it's not a sin.
Forbidden.
Mm. Haram means it's forbidden. Makruh means it's discouraged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is one thing that and I guess Abdullah, tell us. When I was a kid and I used to hear about something that was makruh, I was like, oh, okay, fuck it. Who cares? Because like, they're like, oh, you know, Allah, this isn't haram. It's not going to count. It's not going to send you to hell, but you know, it's not, you shouldn't do it. Try not to do it. And I was like, well, that's like when they tell you something is optional. You know, if I want to do it, I'll do it then. It doesn't matter. I remember they used to say
it matters because they're telling you that it's just good advice for your sake, because Islam cares about you. It's not just, you know, wants you to have a better life.
But yeah, I know. But look. If someone is telling you, if there's a word to talk about, when I was in Islam, I was thinking about heaven and hell. It's like, is this a sin? You know, because it wasn't good for you or bad for you. It was sawab, right? Or thawab, I don't know how you pronounce it. haram, and then there was makruh, right? So makruh was like the purgatory between the two.
Yeah.
So something was rewarded, you know, you do it more, it's going to help you get to heaven. This is basic math. If something is not, it's considered haram, it's going to send you towards hell. You just stay the fuck away from it as much as you can. But if something is makruh and it's in the middle, it's like, oh, this isn't really going to take you anywhere. It's like, okay, I'll do it.
With makruh, there's like different degrees as well. Like there's this one, I think, makruh at tahrimi and stuff. And then there's the big makruh, which is very close to being almost haram, forbidden. And then there's a slightly disliked Makru. So there's like a whole spectrum.
In who gives a shit? Like, it doesn't matter.
Okay, so here's, yeah, but here's, to not, be honest, here's another wrong. Thing. Here's another thing. It. When something is, well, Ali, but here's another thing. When people, when the scholars or the imams decide something is Makru, they could be fallible. So some Muslims might decide, like, you know what, if it's Makru, it has a potential of actually being haram, being a sin. So just to be safe, we're going to avoid the makruh things as well, because we cannot be sure if the scholars got it right. So some Muslims would want to know what's makruh just to make sure they avoid those as well.
Yeah. Well, there's one interesting example that my parents used to give me, and I've remembered this, for was shrimps. In the Hanafi madhab, apparently shrimps or eating shrimps is makruh. But in other ones, it's not, because the argument was that shrimps... they're not part of the, I think it's crustacean family or something, or they're not part of the fish family. I don't know what the reasoning Imam Abu Hanifa came up with, but we were told that don't eat the shrimp. They're disliked, but like, I'm like, I'm going to still eat it. Who cares, right? But that's just one thing that came into my mind. And then the other one, like makru, would be also divorce. Like divorce is allowed, but it's still disliked, right? So it's a very interesting idea, and that there's so much differences between different scholars, and what is makruh to one person might not be to another. To another one might just be straight up haram, right? So.
See, this is the beauty of Islam, because it's not like it's not binary. Like, it's not that simple. Like, good haram, halal, right? Islam recognizes the 72 nuance.
Different. It's like a non-binary. Yeah,
Islam recognizes the nuance and how different actions could be. You know, mean different thing for different people, right? You have to acknowledge that this is God's complete religion. But by the way, see how these, they are just accepting everything I'm saying, because it's just flawless. It's just flawless logic. By the way, at some point, can I respond to myself, given how much you two are failing?
No, this is too good. You can't respond to yourself. And here's Armin, this is what it's like. The reason that we don't respond to you apologists, brother, sometimes is, you know, for instance, if I'm doing an interview with Vladimir Putin, okay, I'm going to ask him, I'm going to grill, and I'm going to say, I'm going to try to really, really challenge him on the questions and catch him out. But if I'm interviewing somebody who's coming and telling me there's a big invisible bunny in their backyard that is telling them to, you know, just drink lots of, I don't know, meal supplements or something, like whatever this large invisible bunny is telling them, I'm not going to sit there and say, oh, yeah, well, show me evidence of the bunny. I'll just be like, so what does this bunny tell you?
This is, this is what ex-Muslims do. I want to
hear a little bit more about it. That's how you approach.
This is so stereotypical ex-Muslims. Because they have nothing to say in response to your arguments, they just make jokes. Every time they have a shortcoming, they just make jokes because they have nothing else to say.
Humor is the most mature defense mechanism. I just want to say, I feel this is amazing. Like, we have, so I just want to say, Abdullah, we actually have one of the most knowledgeable sort of young ex-Muslims here on the show.
Yes.
Basically, we just called this guy who goes, he does these, and Susanna's saying that he does these deep dives and dissections into Islamic literature, into theology. He's just absolutely knows, has a treasure trove of knowledge about Islamic history and all that. And we're sitting here talking about wings and flies. We basically called you here, and we're, oh my god, it's like calling Einstein on an interview and just talking about fart jokes. You know, it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, I don't think I'm anywhere near Einstein. That's too much of a compliment.
No, but go check out Abdullah's Twitter account, because you go deep into these things on your Twitter. What's your? And we are going to have you back on to go about Quran revisions and stuff like that, right? So some more deep stuff. But what is your Twitter account?
Well, you can just Google my name, Gondal, but normally I just started using Twitter like about 2 months ago, seriously, but mostly most of my work is on, I write on Facebook, but I have done a lot of videos with Abdullah Samir, you guys as well, I think it's the third one, with Pakistani Mulhid Haris Sultan in Urdu as well, so, and that's where mostly you'll find my content. But for the deep dive, like you guys are saying with the Quran thing, like recently, just to give a very brief synopsis, is Yasser Qadhi came out with a stream, and he basically straight up admitted that the Muslim narrative about the Quranic preservation that is preserved letter by letter and whatnot is completely, well, it has holes in it. And this has kind of thrown the whole Muslim Twitter, Facebook, Dawah scene into turmoil at this point, where when he said that, Muhammad Hijab, a popular YouTuber, asked him the question in return, if I give you a blank Quran, would you be able to reproduce the Quran we have now? And he said, it's not an easy answer. Straight up said that to him.
He's right.
Because of this controversy, this actually started in 2016 when this one YouTuber leaked these emails from Yasser Qadhi's personal scholarly discussion group to expose him for having these weird, unorthodox views on Quranic preservation. And now what's happened is, so I started posting about this on Twitter, and a bunch of academics, which I was surprised, like I was, but I appreciate that they're engaging, like Dr. Marjan Van Putin and a few other big, big names, leading authorities in the field of this, they've completely bluntly, clearly said that the Quran is traceable back to Uthman with a certain degree of surety, but anything beyond that is an article of faith. And the concept of the letter, dot by dot preservation, the Quran is false. It's not miraculously preserved, right? So that's what's been going on recently. And there's a lot of problems because the way the Dawah scene is, a lot of people are now starting to say that Yasser Qadhi is a deviant. Mm-hmm. Right, and he sits on the top, the pedestal of, like, you know, the North.
Yeah, Yasser Qadhi, for those who don't know, he's a world renowned sort of Islamic scholar.
Yeah,
but he's also not he's not really a deviant, because within universities, within academia, you know, Islamic scholarship, I mean, this isn't something that is an alien concept.
Oh no,
is it? Like the idea what are they called? The Ahraf or
Ahruf and the thing is, so the problem is, like, Muslim scholarship has been aware of this from the beginning of Islam, right? They've written books about it and whatnot. But the issue arises that the layman does not know about this. And
guys, let's not get too deep into this, because we want to make sure that we have another episode on this fully. So let's just tease people with it a little bit, but then we get back.
Yeah, this episode, basically, this is for your listening pleasure, since you know you guys are just having fun out there, and we've got Abdullah Khan. Think of this as like the training.
We'll do like a whole presentation on it. We'll go through like a bunch of books and stuff at Fifi. But just to give a quick tour of thing, that the Quran's preservation has variations at every step of the way, right? From Muhammad canceling verses to the Sahabas fighting over what to put in the Quran to Uthman burning the Qurans, and even after that, we have textual variants that do affect the meaning, right? So. The argument isn't that the Quran is, I will say, relatively very well preserved past the point of Uthman, but beyond, before that, it's a mess.
Okay, we're giving people too much. Yeah. This needs to be a teaser. We don't need to give them.
We'll go into that deep dive later on. Yeah.
By the way, are you looking into this whole new shitstorm of whether Muhammad was even real or not? Are you looking into any of that stuff?
I have looked into it, and the academic arguments surrounding that, like, academia doesn't take the Petra theory seriously. Like Sean Anthony and big names will try to tell you it's Dan Gibson's theory is silly in that sense.
Let's bring that up.
Muhammad did exist, but the reports you were given about him have been convoluted with a lot of, you know, politics and civil wars in the early 200 years of Islamic history. And that created this weird mythical figure almost, and that people use for their political gains.
Okay, so given that we go off track from the main topic, and I want to just bring, before you go, because we're getting close, before we get to Patreon questions, I want to bring us back to the topic, because you guys both failed to respond to my arguments. I'm going to do it myself. Really quickly, regarding coronavirus and why that's not even, there's nothing wrong with God sending us. First of all, people have to understand, there is no room for in Islam, there's no room for suggesting, like some Christians do, that, oh, maybe coronavirus is from the devil, not from God. And that shit doesn't fly, you know. Nobody accepts that in Islam. I mean, you might go find like one fringe Muslim in the corner somewhere. We're like, oh, look, I found a Muslim that says something else. This is almost unanimously agreed by Muslims. You guys tell me if you agree that every single atom and even subatomic particles move because God wills it. There is no room for, no, God didn't do this, somebody else did this. God wills everything that happens is because of God, right?
It's actually funny because there's a part in the Quran, I think Surah 4, verses 78 to 82, where in a succession of verses, one place Allah says, anything and everything bad or good that happens to you is from Allah. But then the next verse, like, the bad things that happen to you are from Satan, but the good things are only from Allah, right?
Yeah, but I'm saying... But the Muslim understanding is that Satan is also a creation of Allah and all of that. So
yeah. So the thing is, like, Satan does have causative powers in Islamic theology, where he can whisper things into you, be running inside your blood, cause divorces and stuff. But if you bring it back to God, then it becomes like, well, if everything God allows it to, then evil is by essence.
Yeah, so but Muslims don't dispute this. Muslims don't dispute it. This is accept, like, even when the devil is doing great evil things, that is part of God's plans, because God is a great, you know, yeah, the devil is deceiving, but God is the greatest deceiver of all. And even though there's evil, that's part of God's great plan. But I'm just saying, like, that's just one thing I want to touch on, because to just mention, like, if there is coronavirus and there is disease or cancer or something, there is no Muslim that will come and say that is not God, that wasn't God's plan. Okay, like, I know we have some disagreements in Christianity and Judaism, but in Islam, pretty much everybody, like, yeah, that is part of God's plan, right? So coronavirus is, for example, coming from God, so we know that, according to Muslims. But the thing is that how, when people's faith, like, we do have a lot of, even though I don't think coronavirus was the worst thing, even close to the worst thing that happened, but there was, because it was covered so much, it did make a lot of Muslims question their religion and why would God do these things. And there was a huge response from Islamic sources to try to respond to all these Muslims who are questioning their faith. And the main understanding is that, you know, if you're experiencing any amount of misery and that brings you closer to God, and you use it as an opportunity to get closer to God and bring humanity closer to God and humble humanity to realize that they're not in control. God sometimes needs to remind humans that they're not in control. They do not, like, all this technology and all this science, they get arrogant. It's kind of like building the tower and then God striking it down, because remind you to put you back in your place, to remember who's actually in control, right? And also, not just coronavirus, any personal misery, that anything that you experience, if that makes you closer to God, that's a net win for you, right? You experience, because this life, this dunya, this is nothing compared to the eternal life that you're going to have after death. Any inconveniences that you have, any pain, any disease, any that you experience, if the result of that is you being close to God, that is infinite times more rewarding than, you know, it's a net benefit for you. Okay, so that's why, that's the explanation. And to be fair, they would be right. That's the problem. This is why you guys can't challenge me on this. They would be right if there was Allah. There's no way to challenge any of these things.
It's just a lot of internally consistent logic, yes.
Yeah, it's internally consistent. If their Allah is real, then everything they're saying makes sense. The problem is that there is no Allah, Right? There is but, no the God. Thing
is, if that if we accept them, then we also imply that Allah as a God is quite like angry, vindictive, jealous, and all that too, right? Because he's like sending, reminding us of diseases and stuff.
Well, because
kiss my ass 5 times a day.
No, because you guys seem to need help because you guys keep forgetting who's in charge. You guys are concerned about so many things that don't matter in this life. And God needs to remind you it's for your sake. But this, again, I'm going to use this whole thing for my plug. This is why the argument, the main argument you need to make to people is why there is no God. Which I published a book in that name.
All advertisement.
This whole episode has just been an excuse for me to market, to promote my book, Why There Is No God. Go buy it. It's very cheap. And if you can't afford it, email Atheist Republic and we'll send you a free PDF copy.
It's basically,
I actually read it, yeah. The first month I left Islam, I read that book.
Oh, yeah?
Good. Yeah, it's very poignant, and the questions are... It's like those hard-hitting questions that everybody asks, and it's very brief and concise, and yeah, it's very...
Yeah, that's why I love it, too.
Atheist, yeah.
It's a great starter thing, especially for somebody who's new to it. It's just an amazing way, especially when you're having conversations, you're having arguments with other people about it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Armin's book is great. And you know, having a relationship with Allah is sort of like, you know, having a master slave BDSM thing without a safe word. Exactly. Right?
Hey, everybody loves BDSM.
I'll beat you and whip you once in a everybody? While as long as you
everybody loves BDSM. I refuse to believe people who say that they're not into BDSM.
Oh my God.
They're just ashamed of it.
I think that this is a thing with sexual deviance.
Well,
they just assumed everybody else is
kinks too, right? Like he would like his behaviors, like he first had like what 11 wives, and on top of that he'd have like sex slaves, and on top of that he'd keep married. He got married to this little girl who he would make scratch his semen off of his clothes and all sorts of bizarre stuff, right? Like he's quite a playboy of his time, actually. If you count the number of women he's been with, like what 20 plus.
Jesus Christ! Yeah, yeah. I just wonder. The only thing I don't know is whether he actually. He really did kill himself in his cell, or whether he was murdered by the Clintons or maybe even the Trumps. I have no idea. Oh, wait, who are we talking about?
Muhammad.
Okay. Oh, we're going to...
All right, let's before, you know, Abdullah has to go to sleep. So really quickly go some, just a few questions. Maybe.
All right. Okay. Let's do that. And by the way, I just want to say that, yes, we had Abdullah. This was like, I absolutely love this. This is a lot of fun. But this, again, is a training thing. We're going to have him on for a longer time. I'm going to find a time that is not before, you know, the where he has more time to spend with us. And we're going to talk about this controversy, this new controversy, which is very, very significant. That's blowing out into the open for the really one of the first times on the internet, this idea that the Quran is not preserved in the form that it was revealed. And there are the most renowned scholars of Islam themselves, or, you know, their ideas about this are actually coming out as well. So I really can't wait for that. I think that let's book that up below whenever we get the chance.
Definitely.
And, but in the meantime, let's take some patron questions. All right, patrons, what's going on? The first question is, Abdullah, are you... Oh, should I give you the timestamps? You want to hold it up, Armin? Or
okay.
Okay. Yeah, so the first question is from Secular Proton. And,
that's a nice name, Secular Proton.
Welcome to our audience, Abdullah. Yeah, Secular Proton. I mean, well, it's you know, it's not Muhammad the job. But he's saying, is Abdullah a Hafiz?
No, I'm not a Hafiz, but I did memorize, I think, about 2 juz of the Quran in total. But I have led the Salah, big congregations, and Tarawih Salah as well, up to 200, 300 people. So,
That's great. Like, I actually, you know, this is something I haven't talked about before.
You should tell people what Hafiz is, maybe, because we have a global audience. Not everybody's.
Yeah, so Hafiz is a person who memorizes the Quran from the beginning to end, word to word, letter to letter, from memory. So if you can start reciting, you can open the book and randomly start reciting from a page. The Hafiz will quickly catch on where you're reciting and you can take it on from memory. So the point is that if you were to erase all the Qurans from the world today and you put a bunch of these Hafiz people in the room, they'll be able to reproduce the exact book from memory because they memorize literally cover to cover.
Most of the Hafiz I have met, and I don't, this is not at all statistical or scientific, this is just my personal experience, so, but have no idea, most of the Hafiz I've met have no fucking idea the meaning of what they're reciting. But I don't, is that your experience as well?
Yeah, so mostly, especially in the non-Muslim majority, non-Arab Muslim countries like Pakistan, Bangladesh, these kind of places, they basically know how to read the Arabic, but mostly have absolutely no clue what is being said at all. So what ends up happening, this is quite funny, this happened because there was an Arab scholar from Kuwait at a function, and this Qiraat function actually, in Pakistan in a competition as a judge. And he asks this Hafiz guy to recite this Quran on stage, and he does it. And everybody goes, Subhanallah, God bless you, blah, 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 so beautiful. But then the guy's like, you do realize that the verses he was reciting was about Allah putting rods into people's skin and then putting oil on their head to burn and torture them, right? So it's not beautiful what you guys are saying. Yeah. So this happens a lot in Pakistan where they have no clue what's being recited. And it's
Go on.
I think, you know, that concludes the point. Yeah. Sorry, what were you saying?
Just to be clear to people, that 80% of the Muslim population is not Arabic, right? And imagine if even people who have spent all their time memorizing the entire Quran, if they don't know what they're reading, what do you think? What does that say about the average Muslim? Hafiz are very rare, very rare.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
They're seen as miracles, right? So if the Hafiz doesn't know what he's reading, what does that say about the average Muslim and how much they know about what's in the Quran? I will actually tell you that the Arab Hafiz sometimes don't know even what they're reading, because it's just like a recitation. You're not actually paying attention to what you're reciting, even if you're speaking Arabic, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But okay. Yeah. Okay. Go on, Ali.
Next question, 1119 from Susanna, is 1119. What is Gondal's favorite silly verse, hadith, or conspiracy?
One hadith that takes the cake for me each time is when Muhammad used to receive the revelations, he would fall on the ground, tremble, and snort like a baby camel. And Omar would be sitting there, and he'd be like, hey, people, come, you want to see Muhammad receive the revelations? We'd lift the corner of the blanket or whatever, people would come look at Muhammad. That one, very interesting.
He was having seizures though, right? Wasn't he having
Well, actually recently I did this deep presentation about almost 3 hours long on the neuroscience of Muhammad, and the guy was firm in my opinion. He most probably had temporal epilepsy or partial complex seizures. Yeah, the evidence is too strong. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it's very completely different topic. That hadith really was like, whoa, like, I mean, that's like, come on.
I mean, the monkey stoning one is the most crazy one to me. Actually, I don't know if the monkey stoning was the craziest one or the Moses running after a stone because the stone stole his clothes and hitting the stone with a stick.
Yeah.
That's number one is the Moses chasing after a rock. Number two is the monkey stoning another monkey because the monkey committed adultery.
Moses something like that, beating up a rock, also in the Bible?
No.
I don't know. I know that Moses hitting the rock with his shaft and 12 water springs coming up.
That's a different story.
Yes.
This one is like apparently Moses was always covering himself when he went and had, you know, bath with other people, and people were like, why doesn't he get naked in front of us? He probably has a horrible disease that he's hiding. And God was like, this, no, Moses is perfect. I have to show people that Moses has a perfect body. So he had that rock steal Moses' clothes, and clothes start running naked, running after the rock and telling the rock to give him back his clothes. And people looked at Moses running naked and were like, oh my God, look, he has a perfect, you know, he's hot and he has a perfect body. He has no, there's no problems at all. And Moses, when he was running after the rock and hitting the rock with his stick, he hit it so hard, apparently he's so strong, that up until today, you could still see the marks
on
the rock. That's how.
Oh, so this is actually in the Old Testament.
In the Old Testament? No way.
The rock?
No.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's an Exodus.
The rock story?
Oh, wow. No.
It's a little different. It's about him hitting a rock. And the Lord said to Moses, pass on before the people and take with thee of elders of Israel.
That's a different story, Ali. Did you even hear what I said?
I did. But wherewith thou smotest the river, take thy hand and go. Behold, I will stand with thee there in the rock in Horeb. And thou shalt smite the rock, and there shall come water out of Elkanah.
Okay, that's the water coming.
That's a different story.
That one's in the Quran too, actually. The Quran did copy it. Yeah.
I'm sure that this is, for some reason, I'm going to ask Seth Andrews about it. I don't know what it is. Maybe I'm getting it mixed up. These scriptures are so easy to get mixed up.
Yeah.
And the thing is, they're all so full of these bizarre things. But if you say that one came from the other one and it didn't, they will descend on you. Like
crucify you. Yeah.
A bunch of rocks.
I mean, if you know their style, like I would know, I know this is something. Okay. So what you just mentioned, Ali, I would have never believed that this is in the Old Testament. If you say it was in the Talmud, I would be like, maybe, but not in the Old Testament. So, I mean, sometimes you just know the level of crazy each one of them. The brands of crazy is different.
Right. So 1127 also from Susanna saying, how is Gondal hoping to expand his work going forward? What is he most passionate about?
I might start my own YouTube channel. I don't know yet. I'm still debating it. I'm still debating, like, should I get more involved in the polemics and stuff, or should I start distancing myself and focus more on other things? Because, you know, there's only so much you can talk about Islam, right? After a while, it dries up. But then again, there's a couple of different things. Like, we are thinking of starting a call-in show, like a completely different format and different from like live streams,
like Harris does.
Yeah, so we're just trying to start that in English. As for my passion, I'm very passionate about like neuroscience and stuff. I might want to study, I like the anthropology side of religion as well.
Yes,
so yes. I might like to study that or read some books on that. But definitely my passion is definitely neuroscience, philosophy, cosmology, and whatnot.
And the Islam side. That's when we need you on that.
Like, that's why there's enough
neurologists out there. What you're doing, there's not that enough people doing what you're doing when it comes to Islam.
I want to make a channel, but I don't want it getting limited to, let's say, just discussing Islam. Mm. I want it to be a variety of things, like not just Islam, but different religions and different extinct anthropological religions that people have no clue about, or stuff about science and, you know, stuff like
that. You could use Islam as an excuse to get to another religions, because Islam, trying to trace where Islam got its different ideas from, is actually a very, very interesting and fascinating hunt. And it gets you into the Hellenism, and it gets you into Christianity, Judaism. That's paganism, you know. And then once you go to Judaism, then you want to be like, where did these ideas come from? It's just that you know, hunt for the sources of these ideas just branches into so many different places.
You can totally see how for example Allah's throne floating above the water before the universe was created. It's borrowed from those water creation myths, right? From so many different civilizations.
There's so many, and that's such a popular narrative that was used so many times, and you could get into so many ancient religions that constantly use this. So even if you focus on the exam angle, you could use it as an excuse to get into so many other places, right?
Oh, yeah.
Abdullah, I have a question for you, too. Just really quick, what are you interested in aside from religion? Is there anything else that you're interested in that you want to talk about? But
lots of things. I mean, I find
that you feel particularly compelled to talk about, but you know, you don't really have a forum to talk about it.
Well, like there are things like I love talking about neuroscience, religion, the psychology of religion, as in from there's a subfield called neurotheology that interests me a lot. But generally, like my interest range, anything from reading books on quantum mechanics to talking about a history of, let's say, World War II or stuff like that. But I do like to. One thing, anthropology, I feel, an anthropological lens is very important. I feel like I have an audience that wants to listen to me talk about Islam, but I would love to talk about religion from a very multifaceted approach and in a way that's not done before. Like one example would be my presentation on the neuroscience of Muhammad, like apply these really new perspectives onto religion. And see what we can actually learn about like the human condition, right? And tribalism and whatnot. And that's something that like interests me. Yeah.
I don't know if the neuroscience of Muhammad makes sense, but given that we know 99% of everything we know about Muhammad seems to be made up. So it's not going to be an accurate, I mean, you could come up with theories about the people that came up with the stories about Muhammad, but I mean, given that we know that the stories are made up, it doesn't really tell you much about.
Well, the thing.
Sorry, go ahead.
For me, the thing is that the descriptions of him receiving revelation in regards to that are so precise to the symptoms we see in modern day neurology, and like if you go through my presentation, it is incredibly precise where they have the exact same hallucination. Like, for example, I show like it's St. Brigida's example. There's a couple of examples where the people would hear ringing bell noises followed by a voice talking to them in a commanding way. So exact things Muhammad experienced. But the thing was, like, there is no reason for me to believe that the Muslim scholars of that time actually concocted these symptoms just sitting there. Because these symptoms don't make Muhammad look good.
Yeah.
So what I feel happened was these people might have actually recorded the symptoms in their own sincerity, thinking they're recording the miracle of Allah happening, that is the descent of revelation. But in actuality, they just recorded the symptoms.
Okay, nobody serious is suggesting that the alternative to Muhammad's stories being fake is that the scholars just sat around and came up with the stories. Mm-hmm. The alternative is that there were many other stories that were floating around, and they were all accumulated into one person, you know, different heroes, different archetypes. And maybe the reason why some of these are familiar is because some of them were based on real experiences of some other people having, you know, thinking that they're getting messages from divine. But it wasn't like this a whole bunch of people that went and sat in a room and like, hey, let's create Islam together, and they just wrote the story. It's a collections of popular stories that were already existing, and they just canonized it. And this also explains the explanation of why some of the stories of Muhammad that are so embarrassing are still there. Is two. One is because a lot of the things that we consider embarrassing was not really that embarrassing for the people at that time. But also the ones that are even embarrassing for those standards were because there were stories that were too popular not to include. Like they were already circulating, there were already stories about local heroes, and maybe people were, you know, like for example, sometimes you have local heroes that is just everybody keeps associating any good story that people come up with this one name that is becoming a popular, you know, container for all the heroism, right? And Muhammad might have been during the Umayyad time, maybe that might have been like something like that, just a local hero figure that everybody just dumped their stories in. And at some point when the government decided to, you know, let's just make this into a religion, they had to make this official, they had to come up with a canonization process, they had to come up with a way to like get rid of shit that they don't like and include things that they like. And actually, that's a much more effective strategy of, because we have a lot of examples of people that wanted to make their own self a holy person, and tell you like, hey, we should lead you because I'm fucking holy. And those fail more often than the strategy of like, hey, listen, there's this other holy person that is dead right now, so you can't actually check anything that I'm saying.
Yeah.
But we're representing that guy. That's always a more effective strategy because you don't have to prove, give people miracles. People are like, if you're sent from God, then how come this? How come there's less questions? And this is what what's his name? The Khalifa, Malik did, right?
Yeah.
And I think, yeah. So anyways.
Guys, we have to, like, because I know Abdullah has to go, so we're not going to get too much into this. I just have to, sorry, cut you off. Hassan is asking you about your position on,
Mahmoud Hassan. Mahmoud Hassan is saying, can Armin please elaborate his position a bit in regards to the recent anti-racism movement? I read a few of his Facebook posts, but I got rather confused. Well, I'm not going to do that here, but I am doing that on Atheist Republic channel, and I'm going to do more of those videos. So if you want to see that, go over there. An Atheist Republic. I'm also going to invite Ali's position is different from me on a lot of these stuff. So I'm going to invite Ali on Atheist Republic to have a discussion with me on it, where I will destroy him live in front of all you guys. It's going to be, you're going to have to call. Anyways, never mind.
Yep. Right. Armin will destroy me, and then history is going to destroy Armin. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, sure. The next question. So let's just do one more because I know I've got to go. I'm sorry. I keep on.
No problem.
Okay. Well, actually, there isn't really much.
No, secular patron. Secular proton.
11:30 T. Budiman. We already had one from secular proton. Uh-huh. What is the Hajj? What is its importance for the Muslim? Do you think it'll be canceled this year? Has it been canceled before? So the Hajj, just really quickly, Hajj is the annual pilgrimage to Mecca that all Muslims, it's one of the five pillars of at least Sunni Islam and also very important in the other sects. But is it going to be canceled? Like, what are you knowing? What are you hearing about it? What are the implications?
I would side with the idea that it would end up being canceled, and this has happened before. It's not an anomaly. There have been pandemics before.
You're saying that it will be canceled.
It probably will be canceled, and keeping in mind that the second wave is going to come, and in Muslim countries like Pakistan, it's just starting to go up.
Right.
And it's too risky with the amount of people that show up there, like, 20 million or something. I don't know.
From all over the world, yeah.
Yeah, it's literally like a time. It's like a nuclear corona bomb almost at that point.
Yeah.
But it's been canceled before. I think it's responsible for
them. Yeah, I think three times has been canceled. I think a few of them was in response to diseases as well. One of them, at least, was in response to a war. I think.
Mm-hmm. But Kaaba's been destroyed like 3-4 times. So.
By the way, Secular Proton is trying to ask a question. Apparently, YouTube is not letting him or her ask it because it's about COVID-19, and I don't know. His question is not going through. So weird. Sorry about that, Secular Proton. We don't have control over that.
Okay.
Weird.
We'll do that. Hey, by the way, you know, you said the Petra thing is thought of as silly, the Dan Gibson thing. Mm-hmm. By a lot of the scholarship, does that apply only to the Dan Gibson Petra thing, or does that also apply overall to the location and the
there is this
Hijaz or
there is problems with the basic narrative where the mosques do point to not Mecca, like they do point north, but then again, like generally, this was top of my head if I remember is Sean Anthony, like, don't quote me on this, but he's a professor as well, and. Couple of other professors of Islamic studies. I think one was it Juan Cole? I'm not sure. University of Michigan, I remember reading.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, they keep saying that it's a lot of cherry-picked evidence, and they don't entertain it with a lot of seriousness, let's just say that.
Mm-hmm.
I, on my own, haven't looked too much into the theory. Like, I've seen that Dan Gibson documentary, the one-hour video he made where he shows the stones that were thrown by the caliph, and they still have those, and how the descriptions match Petra, and how the hadith say there's gardens, but the Mecca doesn't have any gardens.
Oh, yeah, but, I mean, there's loads and loads of it.
Discrepancies, all the crazy stuff.
But even if it's not Petra, the whole idea that it's not Mecca was taken seriously way before this whole Petra was introduced. Yeah,
Mecca itself, because it has no evidence. There's no archaeological evidence behind before what the 8th century that Mecca even existed. Right, that's the problem. Right. And it's off of trade routes and whatnot. So,
we know that it's very like the whole Mecca thing seems to be nonsense. Where what actually was is debated. But most of the suggestions, even before Petra, seems to be around that area.
Yeah, it's definitely around the Middle Eastern area, right? Like
not just Middle Eastern, like specifically around the Jordan, you know, way north. Okay, good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, guys. Abdullah Gondal, thank you for coming on, and I can't wait till we have our proper thing on.
The preservation.
That's going to be
Wild. So I mean, it's really interesting. I think I've always said one of our biggest arguments against the whole reform thing is that instead of reinterpreting scripture, which is just sounds comical a lot of times, and it's not convincing at all to the people who need the convincing the most. The argument really to go by is to challenge the infallibility of the Quran, and now this is something that's being done from within the ranks.
So it's just too undeniable. They can't get away with it.
Well, I'll give you like a brief why this is such a huge problem, right? Because the Quran is the literal speech of Allah. And in the Salafi view, Allah would speak the Quran, Gabriel would hear the Quran, and then bring it down to Muhammad, right? And then there's the idea that in heaven, there's this tablet which has... The mother of the book, the final copy of the Quran, which should correspond with the copy we have now. Mm. Now, what ends up happening is there's a concept of abrogations. So like these verses are revealed and it get canceled. Now, one asks if this is the eternal speech of Allah, but then they get canceled. Are these verses still part of that tablet that contains the eternal speech of in heaven or not? Or do they unbecome the speech of Allah? But that goes back to the argument, is the Quran a created thing or is it an eternal thing, right?
Uncreated word of Allah. The whole concept of the Quran being the uncreated word of Allah challenges the concept of Tawheed, which is the most fundamental thing in Islamic theology.
Yeah. If they're uncreated, like then that means that Allah did not precede the Quran, right? That was a Muhammadite argument that if they're both uncreated, then how could Allah show up before? He couldn't have created it because both of them are eternal.
No, because now you have two divine things instead of one divine thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Huge mess. Like when you go to the theological ramifications of the Qirat and the Ahruf, it's a complete mess.
And political as well, because actually if you look at when different khalifas were supporting the different sides of this argument, I forgot exactly how, but it was very in line with whether people should accept their khalifas as just God's decision for them or no. Like it's very interesting how political, how theology is gets mixed with politics. But anyways,
crazy. Anyway, thank you, Abdullah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone in the chat.
Thanks for having me on.
And we're gonna have you on again. So next.
Oh, definitely. It'll be my pleasure. I'll make a proper presentation for the audience. You know, we'll go through slides and stuff, show them where the variations in the Quranic text lie, so we can get rid of this myth that it's preserved.
Oh, please.
Yeah.
Wait, can you do screen share? Does it have a screen share option?
Yeah, you can screen share in this. Yeah, for sure.
Awesome.
Let's do it. Awesome. And yeah.
One of the things, a last sort of like quick announcement for everybody is that we've had some of our episodes in the past because we had our team changing and a little bit of a scuffle.
Yeah. I'm going to get them out.
So because of the transition, we're going to have a lot of really, really good episodes that we're hiding in Patreon coming out on iTunes. In the next couple of weeks. So there's going to be a lot of content for you to hear. And it's going to be actually pretty amazing. So be on the lookout for that. And
if you haven't heard it, it means you're not a patron. So maybe you should just become a patron. You just should be a patron. Then you haven't missed anything.
That's right.
Yeah, so, link in the description to become a patron.
Tell your non-friend patrons to subscribe to us on iTunes because it's going to be a deluge of like really, really amazing.
Come become a patron and just hang out in the live chat with us. We'll read your comments and your comments will be part of a podcast.
All right. Okay, everybody. Abdullah, good night. Armin.
Love you guys. Thank you. And thanks to our patrons for supporting your show.
Bye. Yeah. Thank you so much.
All right, guys. Bye-bye.
The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadist.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.